Well, John, every Pixar movie is beloved and well-reviewed. Cars is maybe one of the less well-reviewed ones, but how nice is it to be the head of a studio and say, I like Cars, I want to do Cars too?
Well, Cars, you know, Cars is, the first Cars is a, you know, was, it's done something no other film in history, cinema history has done. And that it has grown dramatically in popularity after it's been out of the theaters. You know, if you look at, and a lot of people aren't aware of this, that it is in all the regions, even where, and like internationally, where it did just okay, box office wise, it has grown so dramatically in popularity due to the DVD and seeing it, and it's just caught on tremendously, and it's turned into, so all told, when you count the box office and then all of the product sales, you know, since the first movie, it's made well over $10 billion.
Well, but product sales isn't why you make a movie, right?
No, you make a movie. You make a movie to entertain audiences, yeah. And that's why you make a movie. The product sales is because people love the characters, and to me, that is a testament to how our movie has become so ingrained in people, in families' homes all around the world, and that's why I make movies. It's so much fun, and so this is, you know, I think that the entertainment industry and the entertainment press tends to focus on opening day, opening weekend box office as a measure of the success of a film, and I think it's the true success is out there in people's homes and how much they absolutely love these characters. And I think that we're very fortunate at Pixar to have produced a number of movies, you know, Toy Story movies, Nemo, Monsters Incorporated, on and on, Incredibles, you know, Wall-E, these sets of characters that people just love. And I always say that we strive to create these characters so that they're loved beyond the boundary of the film, that they want to kind of be with again and again. And that's really kind of, to me, the success of our films. And I think Cars is turned into Disney's, you know, third or fourth, depending on how you look at it, biggest franchise after one movie. And again, that's not why we made the sequel. We made the sequel, as we do with all Pixar movies and all Pixar sequels, is because we found a great story. And all three Toy Story movies were made because we found great stories, and the two sequels were really because we came up with ideas that were very different than the original. We don't like to do sequels just to print money and just rehash the same story all over again, which most sequels in Hollywood are. The sequels at Pixar are all very, very different than the original. And you have to do three things really well to make a successful film. You have to tell a compelling story that has a story that is unpredictable, that keeps people on the edge of their seat where they can't wait to see what happens next. You then populate that story with really memorable and appealing characters. Then you put that story in those characters in a believable world, not realistic, but believable for the story that you're telling. And for us, when we get done making a film, then we feel like we've done that. Then when you start thinking about a sequel, you've got a set of characters and you've got the world that you've created. Now we concentrate on telling a different kind of story. And so it's very important for us to tell a story that's different. Cars 2 was so much fun for me because it was, you know, it's a spy movie. You know, they travel around the world, and Lightning McQueen races against all these other cool types of race cars. And that's where kind of the inspiration for this story came from. And then of course, we focus on the heart of the story, which is the friendship between Lightning McQueen and Mater.
I can tell that this film is very close to your heart.
Yeah, very.
You can tell. Larry the Cable Guy was saying that Mater is kind of close to your heart, too.
Very.
Maybe part of you.
Yes.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
Both my parents are from Arkansas. I grew up here in Los Angeles, but there's a sort of connection to, you know, and being sort of an animation geek, you know, we were not the coolest cats, you know, in the school. And I was always felt a little bit like a, kind of like a little kid that's never grown up, you know, in the world of adults and stuff. So I always felt a little out of place at times. And so, and namely, we were on our first research trip for Cars 2, we went to Italy to attend the Italian Grand Prix to see a Formula One race. And we were, the Red Bull Formula One team were so generous in opening kind of up and sort of showing us every aspect of their cars and their pits and their backstage and all that stuff. And they invited us to their big party they were having, which was in the Milan Museum of Modern Art. And this is Milan. This is the home of Armani, you know, and this was the fanciest, glitziest party, coolest, hippest party I'd ever been to. And, you know, I got dressed up. I put my sport coat on over my Hawaiian shirt, and I went there, and I felt like Mater. I felt totally out of place, and I just kept thinking to myself, oh, we got to have a scene like this in the movie with Mater, because I totally feel like Mater. So Mater really is a character that is near and dear to my heart. There is quite a bit of me in Mater. There is Joe Ramft, who was my creative partner on Cars. You know, he was Mater as well. And Larry the Cable Guy has been a big part of making Mater very special. You know, so it's fun to have been there. But this story is I just really enjoyed the story of the friendship between Lightning Queen and Mater in these kind of situations.
Does filming and directing the movie in 3D change the development of the story?
No, not really. What it does is, as the story is a story, it's the most important thing. When you start taking a look at the, and the way we do story is we'll do kind of treatments and scripts, but we quickly get into storyboards, and we will make a version of the movie using still storyboard drawings called the story reel. And we'll work and rework and rework that until we get it working right. When we feel like a sequence is ready to go into production, the first stage is what we call layout. While the story is being kind of developed, we start building all the sets and the assets within the computer, characters and sets and so on, props. And then a sequence comes up, and we'll talk with Jeremy Lasky, who's our director of photography for staging, the head of layout for the movie, and we start talking about how we're going to do the camera work. And that's where a lot of discussion of 3D starts coming in, how to stage things so it looks cool. And we now are so familiar with it. We've loved 3D for such a long time. I shot my wedding pictures in 1988 in 3D. I collect vintage 3D still cameras. And in 1989, we did a short film in 3D, but there was no theaters in the world. It was called Knick Knack. There's no theaters in the world to see it in. And so we've been really kind of looking forward to this. And so we're really familiar with what our medium of computer animation, how perfect it is for 3D, because it's a truly three-dimensional world. But it's like just being really knowledgeable about what works, what doesn't work. Our technique at Pixar of 3D is not the gimmicky coming at you stuff, but it's just sort of making the world, like kind of sucking you into the story a little more, the world kind of envelops around you. I don't want people to think about the 3D. I don't want people to think about anything but just what happens next in the story. But it's all these subtle things that we did knowing it was going to be 3D. Namely, a point, Holly Shiftwell character, her cool screen that comes up, that holographic screen, we did on purpose because it was kind of see-through and stuff, and it was kind of cool knowing how cool that would be in 3D. And little things like that, the water being really clear and being able to see down into it, you know, and it was... So we love 3D, but it's really we don't change the story. We tell great, you know, it's all about telling great stories. We want the movie to play great in 2D as well as in 3D. But when you see 3D, it's really a fun adventure.
John, can you, I know you said the story drove your decision on this movie.
Yes,
but did you have to kind of wait for technology? I mean, this is a big roster. Could you have done this 2 years ago?
No,
the technology you had to wait for.
No, we didn't wait for it to get this place, but it's this way with every Pixar film. Every Pixar film has something in the story that we don't know how to do. Sometimes it's little, sometimes it's not glamorous, sometimes it's kind of something cool. But we will set out to kind of solve it for the movie. One of the big advances that's really great looking in technical advances is the water. If that the spy opening, if you noticed how amazing the water looked, it's really unlike any computer animated water to date, because our guys found this new really kind of heady mathematical algorithm this guy kind of developed in the mathematical circles on trying to think about the math of the ocean, the ocean waves and stuff. And they implemented that into our system. And it was a brand new way of kind of looking at ocean waves. And it really is amazing. The other thing that was really dramatically different in this film is just the level of complexity, meaning the amount of things that are in this film. It's vast. And it's really like 10 times more complex than any Pixar film, you know. And we really kind of pushed the edge of the envelope there. We increased it's what we call our render farm, which is the computers that all the artists access to kind of compute their daily work as they're interacting with the computer. Plus, at night it's doing, you know, all of the rendering, high resolution rendering, and we tripled the size of our render farm for this production and for the future of Pixar. It's just because we were able to do that, and we said, let's just do it, because one of the things for me that I've always, since I've been working with computer animation since the early 80s, is always striving to do everything we can technically so that the artist doesn't have to wait. And as writers, you know, can you imagine a word processor where you're typing and it takes anywhere from 2 seconds to 5 minutes for your words to kind of appear on the screen? Your creative thought process would be inhibited all the time, right? And it's like, you know, you guys are probably so good at the word processors and cutting and pasting and all that stuff and the speed in which you go. It's like, you don't even think about the technology as you're creating. You're just, your mind, your creative mind is looking at the written word and you're just going, right? And that's actually the dream at Pixar of this level of complexity. And that's what we finally starting to achieve on this movie is something that big. Someone described it as like, you know, it's like having a pitch black room and then turning on the light briefly, looking around, closing it, and then going and start arranging the furniture and painting the walls. And then go back, and you think you got it good, and you turn the light on again and see what you did right or you did wrong, and turn the light off and go do it again. And that's kind of what typically it's been, you know, in the really high-end, complex world of computer animation, is that it's so complex. And so as the increase in computer speed is starting to happen now more and more, you know, the things are getting more interactive, even at the highest complexity levels. And then, of course, we take it and run with it and create this world like this.
Can you talk a bit about some of the spy films that you were referencing?
Yes.
And then how you sort of wove that into the world of art?
I love spy movies. Where this idea came from, it actually came from the story development in the first Cars. There was a scene where Lightning McQueen took Sally on a first date, which eventually became the cruising scene with the neon lights turning on. Originally it was in a drive-in movie theater, and we developed a movie that was playing on the screen, and it was a spy movie, and this is where Finn McMissile character first came up. And I just always loved the idea of a spy movie, and part of it came from my personal love of spy movies. It started when I was growing up as a little kid in the 60s. 1964, The Man from U.N.C.L.E. came on TV, and it became my favorite TV show as a kid. And I was Ely Kuryakin playing in the backyard. That was my character. I just, you know, I loved that so much. And they had a really cool spy car in there, too. And then just being in love with all the different spy movies and, you know, the whole genre. I have 5 sons, and we have been really crazy about the 3 Bourne movies and how they kind of elevated the genre to this energy, the way the filmmaking and all that stuff, and we just loved that. And so I was very inspired by this, and so we started taking a look at, you know, the old and the new spy movies, you know, and the Bourne movies, the 3, Bourne Identity, Bourne Supremacy, Bourne Ultimatum, were very inspirational. The Harry Palmer movies in the 60s, the British spy movies that Michael Caine starred in were very cool. The Man from U.N.C.L.E., as I said, I was really into. And so we really took a look at all the different different movies. And in the case of we looked at a lot of chase sequences out of these films. And I think some of the great chase sequences are, there's a, in the first Bourne Identity, the one with the little mini through the Paris, that's awesome. The, one of the great chase sequences is in the film Run In with Robert De Niro. You know, that one's awesome chase. And one of the things that we did with a lot of these chase sequences, you know, throughout them, Bullet is another, you know, of course that's, you know, old school, but it's so cool. And there's, and we took a look at these chase sequences and we realized how often they cut inside to the character, because it's the storytelling of the character in the car driving, you know. And so we said, well, our character is the car. We don't ever cut inside. So we recut a lot of these chase sequences, taking out the cuts to the characters in the cars. And it's very interesting to sit and watch where it's now just the cars. There's no humans involved in this chase sequence. And we learned a lot from that. And it was very inspiring for the chase sequences. And we did that also for racing sequences, too. You know, in from Grand Prix Le Mans, Days of Thunder, you know, lots of different racing films to take a look at, you know, how to shoot the racing scenes as well. And so the spy genre is something I loved. It also extends to the bad guy, because I think, to me, what I love the most about sort of the spy genre is when you have a great, great, great bad guy. And I really, what makes a great bad guy to me is the logic, right? What he's about has to make sense to me. That if I was in his shoes, yeah, right, that makes sense, right? There's a term they use that a great bad guy should be the center of good, meaning in his world, in his point of view, he is doing the right thing, right? He's not sending out, I'm going to be a bad guy. He says, no, I believe this is my world point of view, and this is what I need to do. But then it's like, you're a bad guy, you know, because it's the wrong thing to do. And so we started taking a look at the car world, and this is very typical. What I love about this, you know, the cars and Cars 2, is it's just taking a look at things, you know, in our storytelling, and then take a look at the automotive world and find parallels that are truly out there, you know, from little to big, and, you know, types of cars, you know, things within cars, you know, it's like the notion of the lemons, you know, being the bad guys in this. You know, what is it they're about? We you know, I just started seeing out there in the world, kind of with, you know, from The Inconvenient Truth on, of just sort of oil, big oil versus alternative fuels and that kind of thing out there. And I thought, that's kind of a cool thing that's out there, that really is out there. This is not a message film. It's not, it has any political message, but it just is sort of this, I thought, this is kind of cool. It's out there. Could be a good bad guy verse. And it makes sense. It's like, if you had invested a huge amount of money to find this gigantic oil reserve that costs a lot of money to get to, and you just invested tremendous amounts of money to get to it, and you thought you were going to be sitting pretty, and just as you get there, you turn around, and the world is turning their back on fossil fuel and oil, and going to this alternative thing. It's like, I've got to protect my interests. I've got to do what I can to keep people addicted to oil. And that was the thinking behind the bad guy, right? And so that's what is, and, you know, I don't want you to give it away in your articles, please don't, that Miles Axelrod's a bad guy, but you've seen the movie, you know what it's about. But that was really, it's trying to take a look at the genre, take a look at my love of these genres and the bad guys, and then say, let's take a look at it from a car point of view. What makes sense in a world where cars are alive and there's no humans? And that's where we come from. Even to the minutest little thing, like Mater being an idiot savant about car parts and knowing this thing called a Whitworth bolt, that exists. The Whitworth bolt is real, and it is odd. And it's crazy. And it was in between metric and imperial or inches, you know, and it didn't make any sense. And it caused, and it was just, it's a headache for mechanics, you know, and it's real. And that's what's sort of fun, is to tap into this. Go ahead.
Just the way that you talked about casting Michael Caine.
Yes, thank you.
Inspired them.
The casting of Michael Caine for Finn McMissile really came from the that how Michael Caine so often is portrayed, especially with his Harry Palmer movies, is this suave, cool, you know, guy. He's very cool, and I've always loved that. And he's got a wit, a twinkle in his eye that I think is so special about him. And then on top of that, he's one of those brilliant actors. And he's like working like crazy. He's so good at what he does and everything he touches. And he was a joy to work with. And he was such an inspiration for the character, you know. And so the car we designed the car. It's an original design. It's based upon British cars of the kind of early 60s British sports cars, and also Italian. Pininfarina, the design houses, auto design houses down there, they did these really innovative cars in the late 50s and early 60s. And we just took a look at a lot of cars. And we love the name Fenwick Missile, but we realized there wasn't very many British cars that had fins. But we did find one that was an inspiration for the real little fins of his in the back. But also then, what's fun about thinking about the spy genre and with our thing is that the spy and the spy car are one and the same. So then we start to look, and I love the gadgets in spy movies, and I thought I wanted his gadgets to feel old school, whereas Holly Shiftwell's gadgets were kind of more modern gadgets. And I thought I just wanted to have a lot of fun with the gadgets and stuff, and so, but also his skill, you know, I wanted him to, it's not a parody of a spy movie, I just wanted him to be really skilled at what he did, and that's what was really fun about working with Michael Caine and developing the car at the same time, and then kind of going back and forth with him, and we did a number of recording sessions with him, and I think he loved the character, he loved the story, he kept saying, oh, I wish this was like live action with actors, because I'd love to play this part. It was very complimentary. It was great. And the same goes, I think, for getting Emily Mortimer to play Holly Shiftwell. It was so exciting, because we wanted that kind of sweet innocence, but very smart and kind of tough when she needs to be. And her character, the character of Holly, once Emily came aboard, it just really started to grow, you know, as in importance, and that was really due to a lot of working with her and how great she was. And the same goes for the Francesco character with John Turturro. You know, he was like comic gold working with him, and so we kept putting Francesco in more and more of the movie because we knew it would be hilarious. But that's part of what's fun about the story development at Pixar is it's a journey. You don't just write a script and then that's the movie you make. It's this constant evolution, and be open to that, you know, in that collaboration with the voice actors, collaboration with the artists and animators at Pixar, and you start seeing things that really start coming together, the work that you didn't anticipate, and then you find ways to use it more and more. And so inevitably, when you see like the idea or something that was first pitched for a Pixar film and the finished product, you know, it is the same, but it's totally different as well because of the long evolution of the story development. Yes.
So, I also was really impressed with the Hawaiian Vacation Toy Story.
Yeah.
At the beginning of the movie. Can you talk a little bit about that? Maybe there's going to be more Toy Story shorts coming up.
Where are we at with what we've announced?
Just Hawaiian Vacation.
That's it right now. Okay. One of the things that we love to do is to really keep our characters alive. And we did a series of shorts with the Cars characters called Mater's Tall Tales in between Cars and Cars 2. And it was really fun to do. And so we've had all these great ideas for the Toy Story characters that were... that are not meant to be features, but these fun little short things. And for us, the shorts are very important also at Pixar because we use them to help develop talent, to let some of the younger talent kind of take a step up, you know, and do a story or be a directing animator or direct something, you know, that is an opportunity, you know, for them. So, you know, it's and so it is... it's really fun. And as you know, it's a tradition at Pixar. We always have a Pixar short film on the front of every Pixar feature. And sometimes they're based upon characters that you love, and sometimes they're original, and so we kind of go back and forth all the time. Good, thank you.